Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Russell Klein, registration number 31965, on behalf of the Colorado Securities Commissioner. May it please the court. This case comes down to a simple question of whether or not investments that are mass marketed indiscriminately to hundreds of thousands of people across the country through high pressure cold calling to investors with no knowledge or prior experience in the business being solicited are securities under Colorado law. The answer to this question, as found previously by this court, is yes. Colorado has set forth a roadmap in cases such as Digital Interactive and MECA. That roadmap, like the Colorado Securities Act itself, is designed to protect investors. It's designed to protect investors such as Evelyn Ensminger, who, at the time of her investment, was a 75-year-old retired widowed school teacher with no background or prior experience in oil and gas drilling or exploration. At the time of the trial, several years after she invested, she still didn't understand elementary concepts like what was a well log. You might ask yourself, why did Ms. Ensminger choose to make this investment? Well, like most of the investors, Ms. Ensminger was cold called despite the fact that she had no prior experience in the business being solicited, and she initially said no. But the HEI sales representatives were persistent and kept calling her up to 8 times a day until she finally relented and went along with the investment.
Aren't you just re-arguing your case that you argued in the district court when you present this to us?
Your Honor,
you made all these arguments in the district court, and the district court didn't agree with you on the facts. So what are we supposed to do with that, even if we disagree with the district court?
Your Honor, I think it's important to make a couple of notes in response to that. First, although the trial court made findings of fact regarding some of the testimony that was presented, this court is not limited to those facts that were just found by the trial court. The Supreme Court has previously held in Colorado that it is not limited to the facts just found by the trial court judge, but instead the court can look at those facts that were undisputed in the record, and that's in People versus Pleshakov, 298 P3rd 228. So this court is not limited in that regard. Second, this court's being asked to conduct a de novo review, and that includes looking at the facts in the record and whether they were properly applied to the law that needs to be applied in Colorado in determining whether or not the investments are securities. So it's important to understand who these people are, and nothing that I've pointed out to the court is disputed in the record.
Well, I think perhaps what Judge Berger is suggesting is that we try to spend our limited time on the law rather than the facts.
I understand that, and I'm going to get right to that, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to divide my remarks into two primary areas for focus. First, the trial court erred in its application of Williamson versus Tucker, and second, the trial court erred in its application of the economic realities test in Colorado. Each one of these errors on their own requires reversal. First, the trial court erred in its application of the Williamson v. Tucker case, and as the court is aware, this is the Fifth Circuit decision that looks at whether certain types of general partnerships or joint ventures can be deemed to be securities, in that case under federal law as applied in Colorado under Colorado state law. And the prong we're focused on is whether or not the investors had sufficient business acumen such that they could intelligently exercise their joint venture powers. The trial court found that general business experience was sufficient, and this was wrong. The court was wrong in two regards. First, the trial court said that an overwhelming majority of courts that have looked at this issue have leaned in favor of general business experience. As a matter of simple mathematics and looking at the circuits, this is not correct. Only two circuits, the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, have ever gone along with general business experience as being the basis for the analysis of the investor sophistication. On the contrary, four circuits in every state that has looked at this, so the 2nd, the 5th, the 10th, and the 11th, have gone along with industry-specific experience. But rather than ask this court to referee a dispute between two different circuits that have a difference of opinion on this question, I think it's important to look at why the trial court was incorrect in looking to the 4th and 9th Circuit for their analysis.
Could you tell me first what exactly is the standard that you want us to adopt? Is it that every one of the ventures or partners has to have experience in that particular venture, or some combination of the partners have to have that experience?
Your Honor, I'm hesitant to say that some combination of the partners need to have that level of experience. And the reason why I'm hesitant to say that is because then it becomes a numbers game. Is it 50% or 60%? And if we get into that type of analysis, you're basically saying those people who don't meet the criteria don't get the protections of the Colorado Securities Act that the legislature intended for these types of investments. On the other hand, also, I would point out that when you look at that analysis, that the really none of the investors who testified in this case actually had any kind of meaningful experience in terms of the industry being promoted, oil and gas, drilling, and exploration. So even if it's a numbers game as to who testified, nobody met that criteria, even in the trial court's findings.
Counsel, are you suggesting that the general partnership interest could be a security as to one investor and not a security as to another, depending upon their level of experience in the industry?
No, Your Honor. I mean, an investment is either going to be a security or it's going to be a general partnership.
So hypothetically, if there are 50 investors and one of them lacks industry-specific experience, is it your contention that that would render the general partnership interest as to all investors a security?
I think it would have to depend on the circumstances of the investment, but that's why it's incumbent. If you're going to be a promoter putting together this type of investment, you have to have filters in place if you want it to not be found to be a security to ensure that you're not bringing in unsophisticated members of the public to run a difficult business operation.
But there's lots of partnerships, valid partnerships, I think, that will have a lawyer as one of the partners, an accountant as one of the partners, and maybe if it's an oil and gas partnership, an oil and gas person as another one of the partners. Two of those partners that I described wouldn't have specific experience in the oil and gas venture. Does that make it a security?
I think it depends. One of the tricky things with securities analysis is that it's inherently a fact-specific analysis on a case-by-case basis. And the reason why that's so is so that we don't set up a bright-line test and basically have people say, well, the line is drawn here. We're going to move 1 inch to the right, 1 inch to the left. I think what I get out of your question is you're asking, so different people bring different things to the investment. An accountant can be the tax matters member and a lawyer could help with the legal questions. That's actually not the case. There was not a single investor in these joint ventures who testified about bringing any of their background. So for example, Lois Spreader and Evelyn Ensminger were not asked to bring their elementary school education experience to the investment. Mr. Zipperlin was not asked to bring his experience in the railroad industry. The only investor who testified about being asked a question was Tom Price. Tom Price was not asked about what he can do to improve the investment. He was contacted directly by somebody working on behalf of Reed Cagle to help Reed Cagle with his personal investments. But there was never an instance presented where an investor brought their personal experience, their sophistication and knowledge in some other way other than bringing money to the table in these investments. I wanted to turn really quickly, I know that time is running short. When I was talking about the industry-specific analysis, I did want to point out very quickly why the general business analysis is not the appropriate path to take. The reason is that the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, the two circuits that have adopted general business experience, the Fourth Circuit and Rabana Trawlers rejected Williamson v. Tucker as its basis for approach. It only looks at the four corners of the documents. They don't ever look at the sophistication of the investors. The same thing for the Ninth Circuit, at the time it did its analysis, also rejected Williamson versus Tucker. It doesn't make sense for Colorado courts, which do follow Williamson versus Tucker, to look at circuits that don't actually follow the same test as Colorado. And as I pointed out before, the trial court didn't actually find a single fact supporting the idea of industry-specific experience if this court goes ahead with a de novo review. We have information that one investor took an introduction to geology class. Another investor owned land adjacent to where oil and gas exploration was taking place. And another investor consulted a hydrologist, which actually has not much to do with oil and gas drilling or exploration anyway.
Is the determination of whether something is a security a question of law or fact or both?
I think that the courts in Colorado find that it's a mixed question of fact and law. The determination of the law as to what qualifies as a security and then application of the fact to that law. So I would say as relevant here, it's really a question of law, but courts have viewed it both ways, Your Honor. I'd like to turn very briefly, because I plan to reserve a minute or two for rebuttal, to the question of the economic realities analysis. And there are two cases that are on point here, and that's Digital Interactive and Mika. And both of them talk about control as it relates to the investors. In Digital Interactive, we're talking about the idea of circumstantial control, how the investors exist vis-a-vis one another and the promoter. So the fact that they were numerous, geographically dispersed, strangers to one another, strangers to the promoters, no background in the business being promoted, and the management would be vested in a day-to-day basis on a committee with expertise. All of those factors are present in this case, with one additional factor that I think really illuminates why this is a problem. The investors were not provided the names, addresses, and phone numbers of any of their fellow general partners at the time they made the investment. They had to send a letter to HEI and HED saying, can I please have the names of my fellow general partners? That's not something you usually find in a general partnership, and the lack of information frustrates the investor's ability to actually organically exercise control over the joint venture.
Can I ask you to address the presumption, the Williamson presumption, or so-called Williamson presumption? And specifically, can you think of any valid purpose the Williamson strong presumption provides or gives?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to make three quick points about presumptions, and then I'll answer the second part of your question, if I may. First, Colorado has never adopted the Williamson presumption. Two, even if it did, the factors in Digital Interactive and MECA, both of which rely upon Williamson, were sufficient to overcome the presumption, if it applied at all, in those cases. In the case of MECA, we're talking about a virtually identical investment. Three, it's important to understand what presumptions are and what they do. Presumptions don't change the burden of proof, nor do they supercharge the burden of proof, and they're not evidence. They're just ways of viewing evidence. Classic example of a presumption is in an automobile accident. We presume that the rear vehicle caused the accident, but once we go to trial and we have a case, we look at the evidence. Front vehicle had its shifter in reverse and witnesses saw the car backing up. You don't then take that evidence and weigh it against the presumption. But that's exactly what the trial court did. This is treating the presumption as evidence. The trial court said balancing the additional aforementioned factors and weighing them against the strong presumption that joint venture interests are not securities, the plaintiff has failed to meet his burden. That's not how presumptions work under Colorado law. Frankly, I think that the presumption, one, has never been adopted and shouldn't be adopted in Colorado because it facilitates fraud. Second, even if the presumption does apply under Rule 301, presumptions generally don't change anything at the end of the day as long as some evidence is presented moving forward in the trial. In other words, you can't ignore where a presumption has been applied, but once you presented some evidence against it, we move forward and the burden of proof is as originally would have been applied in the case, presumption or no presumption. I hope that answered your question. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, Paul Schwartz, 29729 for the appellees. Mr. Klein said something that's exactly right, which is that these issues are inherently fact-specific. And Judge Martinez in this case considered all of the evidence and he made a fact-intensive decision that is entitled to not de novo review, but under Rule 52, deferential review with due regard to his opportunity to judge the credibility of the witnesses. With respect to your specific question, Judge Berger, certainly the Williamson 2 question, which is whether these partners had the capability to meaningfully exercise their partnership powers, is inherently a fact question. There are four key flaws with the commissioner's argument with respect to business experience. First and foremost,
But Mr. Schwartz, if we reject the strong presumption under Williamson, don't we at a minimum have to send it back? Because how do we know how the trial court applied that presumption in making its findings and conclusions?
I agree, Your Honor, that if the court concludes that the judge, the district court, applied the wrong standard by applying the Williamson presumption, then you're right. But he didn't, and here's why. Let me take my argument out of order and address that issue. I agree with Mr. Klein that the key to resolving the Williamson presumption issue is understanding what the presumption is and what it isn't. If you look in Black's Law Dictionary, you'll find about 2 pages worth of definitions of the word presumption. It means all kinds of different things. One thing is simply a deduction of one fact from another based on common experience. That's all the district court did here. They recognized, as essentially all courts who address the issue have, that if a partnership agreement and governing general partnership law give the general partners the rights, the powers, the fiduciary duties, and the incentives to actively manage their partnership, then as a practical matter, it's difficult to establish the third prong of Howey because those rights, powers, duties, and incentives are inherently contrary to the third prong of Howey. That's just a common sense deduction. As I think I heard Mr. Klein acknowledge, by using the presumption, the district court did not shift to the state any burden that it had, that it did not already have. It did not heighten the burden. It did not elevate.
Well, counsel, you say it didn't heighten the burden. What does it mean to say it's a strong presumption, which is a term that the trial court used repeatedly?
I think it's exactly what I just said, Your Honor, which is that as a practical matter, when the issue is reliance on others and the partners, as a matter of law, as a matter of contract and governing partnership law, have the rights and the powers and the incentives and the duties to actively manage their own partnership, it's a recognition that that's difficult to overcome. That said, the district, obviously the Williamson framework provides a number of different ways that someone challenging that assertion, that asserting that there is a security, can overcome it. And the district judge stated explicitly on page 1 of his opinion that he made his findings, his determinations, including the issue of whether these partners did or did not have the practical capability to exercise those partnership powers by a preponderance of the evidence.
How is an appellate court supposed to apply the strong presumption?
Well, I think the answer to that, Judge Berger, is that the quote-unquote strong presumption is simply part of the facts in that it is a recognition of the rights, powers, duties, and incentives of general partners. So in looking at, I think your task as the appellate court is to look at whether Judge Martinez considered all of the factors that he should. And MECA and Digital Interactive, they're all about factors that get considered in the totality of the circumstances. Did he consider all of those factors that go to the ultimate question of whether the partners were able to exercise meaningful partnership powers, and were his findings supported by evidence? And that's where, for example, this stuff about the prior business experience comes into play, because the extent and the nature of the partner's prior business experience is just one thing that the fact finder must consider when analyzing the second Williamson factor. Long v. Schultz Cattle, which I think is fair to say is the commissioner's main case on this subject actually supports affirmance, not reversal.
But Judge Martinez said he did consider and apply the strong presumption. What does that mean? What do you take it to mean? And how am I and my colleagues supposed to deal with that?
As I've said, I think what it means is that he recognizes, as Williamson did, as all the federal courts, including the cases that they cite for various other purposes in this case, that themselves endorse and apply the so-called Williamson presumption. What that means is a recognition that a powerful part, a significant part of the economic realities of general partnerships is that partners have the right to make decisions for their partnerships, for their businesses, that they have the right to get rid of the managing partner if they want, that they have the incentives to do that because they face unlimited personal liability if the business screws up, that they have fiduciary duties to actively manage the business, that they have rights under partnership law, in this case it was Texas partnership law, to enforce all of those rights and duties. And all the Williamson presumption, whether you call it a strong presumption or a presumption or whatever, all it is in this case, as applied here, is a recognition of those things that I just said, which are undeniably the case, alongside the fact that ultimately, under the Williamson analysis, which courts apply and which this judge applied, you consider everything else to determine by a preponderance of the evidence whether the partners had a meaningful ability to exercise all of those rights and powers. It's not, as the state admits, Judge Martinez did not say, you have to find, I'm going to think about whether the partnership powers were meaningful or could be meaningfully exercised. The state has to prove that by clear and convincing evidence. He didn't say that. He didn't do that. To the contrary, he said preponderance of the evidence. And I would note it's important here, Your Honors, that in Cable versus Mathers, the Colorado Supreme Court specifically held that it is incumbent on the courts of this state to, when interpreting the Colorado Securities Act, to coordinate that with like provisions of the Federal Securities Act, including specifically by following the reasoning of the leading federal authority on the issue. That's what the court did in Cagle. Here, it's indisputable that the Williamson analysis is the leading, indeed, I think, universal federal framework and federal authority on this.
But not the presumption.
Yes.
No, no. I mean, there. We've been looking at this very carefully, and there's lots of federal cases that, as you say, follow Williamson in terms of the three factors. But there are many cases that reject the presumption or don't apply it. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree that federal cases reject it. I agree that not every case uses the word strong presumption or heavy burden or difficult burden or things like that. I agree with that. But again, ultimately, Your Honor, it's a question of what the presumption is and it isn't. It isn't a heightened burden. It isn't a heightened standard of proof. It's simply a recognition that these facts that arise from the contract and from partnership law, that the state discounts. This is exactly why it's there. This is the answer to your question, Your Honor, I think, about why that language is used. Because the state, in this case, makes the argument that we are, and the district court did, elevate form over substance by referring to the contract and the rights and the powers in the contract. They say we're elevating form over substance. That's not true, and that's why this recognition of the presumption is so important. Recognizing form over substance would be saying this document, this contract is labeled, is called a general partnership agreement. Therefore, it's not a security. What that's different from saying the content of this contract includes various rights. The right to control the business simply by a 51% vote of the partnership. The right to replace the managing venturer with or without cause. The right to do anything and everything. And those are significant rights and powers.
So are you saying that, I'm sorry.
I don't think anybody's suggesting that the court can't consider what the law is and what partners' rights under the law are. I think the problem is, to get back to Judge Berger's question before, is what beneficial purpose the presumption serves. It seems to me, I haven't heard one articulated, and yet I'm hearing that, or it seems to me that there's a real danger in applying it because it can be applied as evidence. That is, if I apply a strong presumption, then my bar is set way up here. And to satisfy your preponderance of the evidence test, you've got to present enough evidence to get way over this bar.
Right.
And that, I got to tell you, it looks like the trial court may have done that.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I don't think that's what the trial court did, and I'll keep trying to explain why. But before I do, let me get to the policy justification for the kind of thing you were talking about, if the trial court had applied it. And that is, we got to remember the implications of something being declared a security or not. It's not just a matter of looking back afterwards in the context of an enforcement action and making a decision in retrospect. If something is a security, right, then action has to be taken at the very beginning of the company. The company either has to go through the registration process, or they have to make sure that an exemption from a registration applies. So there is a certainty, or a reasonable certainty, that businesses have to have at the very beginning when they form the business, to know what they're dealing with so they know what legal obligations they have and they have to comply with. So a presumption, and presumptions of the burden shifting type or of the heightened burden type, do exist in Colorado law.
But isn't that a legislative judgment? In other words, I can understand, based on exactly the rationale you just gave, that the legislature is saying, you know, we're going to apply a clear and convincing standard of proof to the determination of whether something is a security, because we think that most general partnerships aren't a security, and we don't want to encumber people who are legitimately trying to create a general partnership with the fear that they might later have been determined to have created a security and not complying with the securities laws. But isn't that a legislative judgment, not one for us to make?
I think those kinds of policy judgments can be legislative. Without a doubt, Your Honor, courts have recognized presumptions to give effect to policy judgments that are consistent with the statutory scheme as they see them. But that brings me right back to the main point, which is, in recognizing the strong presumption, or using that terminology, the court did not. The ultimate issue here, the ultimate issue was, do the partners have meaningful partnership powers, right? Is it a bona fide partnership, general partnership, or an illusory general partnership? There is no indication, even through the use of those words, that any court imposes a heightened burden on the plaintiff in doing that.
Counsel, your time is up.
I'm sorry, I see. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to bring us back to the reason why we're here, and that is protection of investors. The reason why Colorado has never adopted the Williamson presumption is for two reasons. One, if you look at Williamson versus Tucker, there actually is no presumption contained within that case. The only thing referenced is, quote unquote, a heavy burden. The presumption comes from a different case called Humans v. Simons, which has never, ever been adopted in Colorado. The fact of the matter is the presumption facilitates fraud by removing the ability of regulators to protect investors. If you look at Rule 301...
How do you think the trial court applied the presumption? I mean, I just have difficulty understanding the thought process of how one would apply this presumption. What do you think the trial court did?
I could only go, Your Honor, by what the trial court put in its final order. And if you look at paragraph 30, page 32 of the trial court's order, what it said was it was weighing the strong presumption against the factors that were demonstrated in this case. There's two problems with that. First of all, you're weighing it like it's evidence, which is improper under Rule 301. Second, there's no such thing in Colorado's presumptions or any presumption anywhere of a strong presumption. You either have a presumption or you don't have a presumption, but there's no strong presumption under Colorado law.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.